Accession number 14983, Albert Shippen, Reel 9.
Mr. A. Shippen, Reel 9. We're talking about hand grenades, Mr. Shippen. Were there any accidents in your experience?
Oh, yes. I remember we were up in Stanhope throwing these hand grenades. And, of course, what happened was people used to panic quite a bit. And on one occasion, the thrower... more or less dropped the grenade, and the people in the throwing pit, as it then was, the NCO and the recruit, didn't get out in time. Although they weren't killed, they were very badly wounded, and they had to be rushed off to Drybane Hospital very, very rapidly, because he just panicked and pulled the ring out. Instead of carrying out the drill as he was told to do it, he must have just put his finger in the ring, held the thing, pulled the thing, realised what he'd done, let the lever go, and then said, "Good God," and dropped it, and that was it. So we had a casualty of an NCO, I think it was a corporal at the time, and one recruit.
When there were accidents like that, did there have to be an inquiry?
Oh, yes. Yes, every time there was an inquiry. Because one of the other things that they were very keen on was the actual mechanism and that of the grenades. Because these would come out on the mass production line, and you couldn't have... people in the front line if the mechanisms weren't right in the grenade. So each batch that was thrown in that, it had a number on it, that, and I know we used to record it in a book, the number of the batch on the boxes that came in, so that if there was any thing going wrong with that particular batch, they could trace it right away back down the line and find out what the thing was. Yes, they were very keen on those kind. In fact, the just to revert back a bit to the Home Guard, they had when they used to go on training and this kind of, they used to record sprained ankles and such forth and that, because I suppose more so the Home Guard, because they were working in civilian capacity in. The war effort, and of course the army, if they got no pay from the civilian employers, the army had to pay them compensation for being damaged or trained while they were on training with the army.
Did you do any training in your 3 months fighting tanks?
Well, we only did very. Small amount of that. We went to Katwijk on a number of occasions, and they were just bringing this into being. But like all forces and all arms, I don't think the tank people like to envisage, like you see in the Russians, the infantry sitting on the outside of the tank going into action. And I think that the majority of infantry, and that would prefer to fight on an infantry footing with tank support, but it made the sections and that was round the tanks, in our opinion, being infantrymen, very vulnerable to the infantry, because the tank was definitely a prime... objective to the enemy. So therefore, if you were all squatted round a tank going into anything, you would probably get inflict quite a number of casualties, as well as getting a tank, he would get quite a number of infantry. But the units as they came along and were developing mechanized warfare and this kind of thing. But I don't think at that stage the army or the even industry could have produced enough kind of mechanized infantry carriers at that time. I think they were more concerned with ensuring that people were getting ready for the second front. Because if you go back in history and look, the second front was actually nominated to take place in 1943, but because of lack of equipment and this kind of thing, and they weren't able to jack the thing up enough, it was put back to 1944. And when you consider the amount of equipment and the movement and logistics and that involved in that, well, it was just unbelievable. People were thinking on these kind of things, but I don't think they would. It was envisaged so much to give tank. I suppose if you go back to the the Guards armoured divisions and that was a different kettle of fish. They were armoured divisions, where majority of the Dunlop infantry were in infantry divisions.
In your 3 months training, did you do anything with mines?
And
so on?
Yes, we did. We did marking out minefields with tape and everything. We had to plant them. We had to push mine, which was the mechanism was by a push, which if someone stood on the plate, it had like a razor edge on it, and it went down and broke the wire that was holding the detonator into place, and it would cut it. That was the push mine, and then there was the pull mine, which obviously worked in reverse. If somebody walked into a toilet and pulled the chain, the mine would go off. And we learnt how to take mines up. We had the old 18-inch bayonet where we used as a prodder into the thing. But a lot of the people as well improvised with like a long poker kind of thing in their own thing. It wasn't so clumsy to carry as the bayonet and this kind of thing, and the mine product. And then of course we learned how to lift the mine and how to carry them out, because they were primed, so we had to know where the primer was that had been put in, the detonators and so forth and that. So we learned quite a bit about mines. And then of course we had the one which I thought was a bit naughty, and it was like a big chocolate box thing, and they used to say, well, string three or four of these together, and as the tank's rumbling down the road, pull them across and they'll blow the track off. I don't think anybody ever tried it really. But there was about five or six different types of mines that I remember. There was the personnel mine, which would wound the personnel or blow his leg off or something like that, inflict a wound on him. And then, of course, there was the mine fields that was laid permanently to stop anybody coming through on an attack. So they'd have to find it, and this kind of thing. They were sent out by the battalion pioneers and that. But oh yes, we learned all about mines and how to prod for them and go, because the area you're going to move over was very important, and you probably had a minefield of say 50 yards to cover, so you had to make sure. And of course once you got a gap through it, then the enemy also knew you were going to concentrate to go through that gap, and therefore he would train his weapon on there to inflict as much casualty as he did. So people were very conscious of the mine as a defence weapon, and also to stop you from putting in attacks. And there again, the danger was, if you were with tanks, the weight of the tank would probably set off not one mine, but a number of mines as it went over them, blow his tracks off, set him on fire, and also inflict quite a number of casualties on the infantry, which were following up behind them. So we weren't all that keen on this method of going in with tanks supporting us gathered round the back of them.
Yet this was part of infantry tank cooperation, was it not?
Oh yes, yes. But as I say, I think that the tanks preferred to go in on their own and do their job, and I think the infantry 9 times out of 10 did their job. Although people were trying the tank cooperation, yes, but I think when the two were together, I think the commanders who have got to realise they're like the captains of the ship. They're making the decisions, although you were trained to do something. When you were doing these attacks and this kind of thing, it was the people on the ground who saw the features, what the enemy strength was, who made the decisions. And it was no good someone coming back later on and saying, well, you should have did a left flanker there. You would never know whether you were right or wrong. But people would say, well, this is the way we will do it. And I think the commanders had sufficient knowledge to know if it was a viable proposition to go in with tank support, or for the tanks to be behind the infantry and give the infantry support when they got pinned down and this kind of thing. It was a question of what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Were the mines that you were training with, were they German mines?
Oh yes, both German and the British mine we had to know. Because of course we had to know how to find out the detonators and what kind of mines and that the Germans invade. And of course we also had to know how to put our own mines in a defence position if we were going to stay there any longer. So both were conducive to one another. Like the majority of training, we're more or less concentrated on the German aspect of the war, but of course there was also the Italian side to consider at the time, and also the Japanese side, which didn't come on till later on, where we learned all about where the Japanese dug these trenches and put bamboo canes in with sharp spikes on, then rubbed them with rotten meat, so that when you fell through them, it went through your boot and everything, and you ended up with gangrene and all this kind of thing. And how they used to have these snipers in the tree, and how they would stay up there for periods of time and let you pass a number of patrols, and then the next time the patrol went out, he would do it. So we learned all about those things eventually, but the majority of it, that when you were in the training camp for your first 3 months, was based on the German asset. It was later on that we learned all about the Japanese side. And one other point that comes back to memory now we're talking about the side, we learned about internal security, and we used to learn about these things because of the disturbances now that took place in places like Egypt and India, and that which the army used to get involved in with the civilian population. And we learned how we would go forward and confront the leaders of the demonstrators and this kind of thing. And one of the jobs of the bugler was to bring everybody's attention to the fact that we're there, and they would blow the bugle, any call or anything you would want. And then we had a chap there, we used to call him the scribe, who wrote down all the procedures that was taking place. The bugle blew at so and so, so and so. The officer confronted the so and so, so and so by such and such a time. We then told them to move off in orderly, and then they didn't. The troops then formed all the square or something. We told them to fire over their heads and this kind. So we went on that progression as well. Which, when you work it out, you didn't know what theatre of war you were going into, but all these little things were done to give you some kind of idea that if you come across this kind of thing, you would have some kind of training to go into it.
Did your training take in working with other arms of the forces? I know we've mentioned tanks. Did you ever work with air support in a training capacity?
Not during the 1944 kind of period, and that, yes, later on in the army career, yes, definitely, but not at that period. To give you a laugh about this, I remember we'd come back from Greece, and I think it was about 1949 or something, and we were stationed at a place called Monkton Farley, just outside of Bath, and were assembled, all the troops are this place, and we were sent off to Warminster by transport and to see a demonstration on mechanized infantry with air support at the I remember the name of the village, it was called Imber, and the Lancashire Fusiliers with the demonstration battalion. And of course there was all sorts of regiments, as you can imagine, stationed in that area, Warminster and so forth down there, Salisbury Plain thing. So we were all assembled on this bank side to watch this demonstration, and I remember there was all sorts of people there, generals and other arms and Americans and all sorts of people in this kind of thing. We were sat on this bank side and we saw this demonstration of what the infantry was going to do, be mechanized, going in, which later I think it was nicknamed the pig in this kind of thing, where you had a section in a semi-armored car kind of thing. So we're watching this demonstration and the artillery coming in and giving it support with smoke and everything. Everybody was clapping and so forth. And we had these great huge loudspeakers as the training staff was telling us what was happening in this kind of thing. And he said that the air support, ground to air support, so we'll now switch over to the commanding officer of the attacking force, and he wants air support. Well, off came the loudspeakers, came the RT procedure. Hello, Alpha Bravo, this is Charlie Wan. I need air support at grid reference, blah, blah, blah. And two meteors, which was unique to us. We'd never seen the damn things, which was the before our lives, shot out of the sky as if someone was throwing a dart at them at the unique moment that they wanted air support. And so there was a great, you can imagine, about a division of people, 10,000 soldiers, give them a rousing cheer.
Was part of your training, or did you take in lectures about the Germans and their tactics and methods?
Oh, yes. Yes, and the uniforms and the insignias and so forth. And you were encouraged, although a lot of people didn't, were encouraged to learn German. We were taught aircraft recognition, the difference between a Hankel and a Dornier or a Spitfire or a Hankel or whatever it was, against our own planes, which is the Halifax and the Whitleys and the Bofors and whatever, the Lysanders and this kind of thing. Very important because, I mean, at some stage or other, if someone said, oh, it was one of ours, and down came a rain of bombs, like it wasn't very satisfactory to anyone. But we had, and we also had also posters, which were placed at strategic points, such as the toilets and this kind of thing, to teach her about the German arm, what was, and insignias and so forth. And I think the myth had grown up about the German army. They were invincible because of the Blitzkrieg and all this kind of thing. And I know that we used to get lectures from people and that, but the object was to sit down and say, well, look, okay, they did this and they did that, but we did this as well. It wasn't always the one-sided, but people used to think that they were invincible because they took on Poland and they took on France and they'd gone into the Middle East with the Africa Corps and all this kind of thing. But then the army started to fight back with its APKA, Army Bureau of Carried Affairs and this kind of thing, to enable the blokes to have confidence and a morale builder that, well, okay, they were supposed to do this, but at Mercer Matruh we did that, and at Tobruk we did this, and our Navy's done this, and sunk the Bismarck and did this kind of thing, and the RAF has done so many sorties and this kind of thing, the bomb in Berlin and the Ruhr and all this kind of thing. So we got a, they got a feedback like that.
In the lectures, did they explain to you or point out to you the differences between various German units from the point of view of fighting qualities?
Well, I think everybody understood more or less, you know, the SAS, the SS, and so forth and this kind of thing. But we also got pointed out that, you know, we saw newsreels and you heard things and that about the German tanks and all this kind of thing. But we also were informed, if my memory serves me correct, that the German army had a tremendous lot of horse-drawn vehicles and this kind of thing. And that there was only like the front-line people that had these great multitudes of weaponry and all this kind of thing. But the backup people and this kind of thing were very, very strung out for both equipment and uniforms and so forth and that. So they had a soft underbelly at the end of it. And as I say, this is what they were, they did as a morale builder, and also to tell us that they weren't invincible, that they weren't all things. They made mistakes the same as what we did.
Were you being told about their weapons? Which particular German weapons were respected?
Well, I think the one that everybody would, the Smeiser, the hand pistol and this kind of thing, like, which was equivalent to our Sten, which was much superior. And the one that frightened the pants off everybody was obviously the machine gun, the Spandau, which had a tremendous name. And, of course, they also, the other weapon, if I remember correctly, was the 88 that they had, which was very, very renowned for its capabilities in all roles and so forth. And of course, being infantry, we also learned about their tank capabilities. I mean, when the Tiger tank came out, a 70-ton tank rolling down at you wasn't going to be a Sunday afternoon picnic. And of course, we had the 2-pounder. And then we moved to the 6-pound anti-tank gun. And then eventually, after the war was over, we got the 17-pounder from the Royal Artillery, which must have been a godsend because you had 6 of those. And you could use them in, other than anti-tank, you could use them in another role, which give you more or less your own artillery support, along with the 81mm mortar, which I think should have been done in the first instance.
So essentially they were teaching you to respect the German, but that you could beat him.
Oh yes. And proved that they did, in more than one occasion.
So at the end of your 4 months training, what happened next?
Well, you were the great day came along when you were issued with a 7-day pass and a 7-day ration card, which you clung to very diligently. and you will be warned wherever you're going. You packed your kit in your kit bag, and off you went with the whole lot, regardless.
Sorry, had there been a passing out parade for you at the end of your training?
Oh, yes. Everyone, as you went through. And the funny thing about that, I remember particularly, the platoon sergeant that I had, I can't remember his name. The corporal was called Taylor, the lance corporal was called Smith, and I can't remember the sergeant. I have a photograph of the platoon I was with, but I can't remember the sergeant's name. But it was his last chance, to put it bluntly, if his platoon didn't come within the first two or three of the passing out parade and that, he was on his way to some far-flung outpost of the British Empire. And by some quirk or other, we came out top. But not only the passing out parade, during the period of coming up, we also were periodically tested on our abilities of other things. So we did the parade at the end of the thing, marched past the colonel, and it's kind of to pass out, as they called it. But each platoon was automatically examined. And the individuals were even back-squatted. There was no reason at all they would move forward to the rest of the platoon if they went up to the standard. And there was quite a number of people back-squatted. In fact, if I remember correctly, they had a platoon of people who were back-squatted. These were people that had been back-squatted on a number of occasions, and they just couldn't let them loose with live ammunition or anything in that. And those people were on the last kind of thing, because if they weren't going to be any good as infantry, they would end up in the Pioneer Corps. Not that I discredit the Pioneer Corps, don't get me wrong, or the Royal Army Medical Corps. Now, there's a job for everybody, and they were as essential as anybody else, as an infantryman or a pilot was. There was a job to be done, but they weren't suitable for that particular job, so they were back squatted into different things to find out where it is. And then, of course, as the thing came into being, and they brought in what they call the GSC thing, where you did 6 weeks and then you went through a personal selection. That was the way to find out what each individual was going to be doing his best at. But at the front end, they didn't. It was just you were banged into the infantry or whatever it was.
What was the GSC?
Well, it was the General Service Corps, and what happened was that you were called up and you were put into the GSC and you were given the Royal Coat of Arms. That was your cap badge. You did 6 weeks training there, and in that 6 weeks, you were then assessed by the personal selection officer to what arm you were going into. And after that 6 weeks, you went off to be an artilleryman, or you could go off, if you were a medical student, you went off to the REMC. Or if the army needed drivers and you were a driver, you went to the RESC, and if you were a cook, you that. So they were putting round pegs into round holes, where before they could be putting square pegs into round holes.
So you picked up your pass, your rations. What happened then?
Well, you packed up your kit, because you took all your kit with you, regardless, in case there was an emergency. And off to the railway station, most times out of ten, and then off to your 7 days leave. Now, when you came back...
Where did you spend your leave?
Well, I had a friend who lived in Poplar, London. I'd never been there, to London in my life, so I spent one of my leaves with him in Poplar, and being a Cockney... and me being a Geordie, I don't think the twins should ever meet as far as the language was concerned. But it was very enjoyable. And then on another occasion, I had a friend who lived in Derby, and his family were connected with the London, Midland and Scottish Railways in those days, and we spent a very enjoyable holiday on trains, lashing around the country and being in Derby.